Hello and welcome back to another round of Is My Floor Level or Am I Just Shit? The handstand cast would be Emmett Lewis and my glorious co-host, Mikael Christiansen. How are things going, Mikael?
How are things going? I'm not sure. It's been too few hours since I woke up. So let's say it's pretty all right. Home for a few days and going on a vacation with the lady in a few days, or not in a few days, tomorrow. Ooh. So that's going to be grand. So finally, travel. That's not just what's it called? Work. So other than that, just came home from your place, Emmett.
Yeah, we were just filming some new courses. It's kind of interesting, the details of which will be released soon. That means I think we've got four new courses to drop soon in the next while.
Yeah, there are a bunch.
Some advanced shit for you advanced shit eaters.
Yes. Yeah. Advanced shit for you advanced shitters.
It's definitely, it's one of the things I noticed actually, because I've done a lot of photography with the models as well on the last couple of days. And one thing I'd like to point out with the models, we had Josh and Emma. Josh, who's already been in one of the courses, Push Harder, and Emma Leitola. And when I was filming or taking the photos, there's the difference between them and intermediate balancers, I would say, is they can display all the errors. Like if I needed them to do a mistake, so I could photo the mistake in whatever shape they were doing, one arm, two arm, they could do the mistake on the demand. So does that mean it's a mistake? But it is kind of interesting that it's like there's a degree of variability in their balancing skills that most people don't have at beginner and intermediate. There's only kind of like, there's one way, there's your mistake that makes you fall out. Whereas on the more advanced, it's like, okay, we want a straight handstand with two open shoulders, with two closed shoulders, with the back arch, with the hips piked, all these kind of details that you could put into document. That was very interesting, sort of, just when I thought about it, I was like, oh, you know, maybe there's a thing or a guide that maybe instead of stretching, instead of balancing in one prescribed form, you could be practicing the mistakes as well.
Mm. Yeah, I think that, like, I mean, it makes sense that, like, once you're past a certain level, you, like, those things become more like choices than anything else. Given that you are in balance and you can move freely between them, and of course, I mean, like when you stay in a position and you make a mistake, like basically, if you stand in a handstand and you start losing balance, no one is going to get straighter by losing balance. For the most part, like your form isn't going to like. Basically, if you're losing balance on two arms, you're not going to go to one arm and save it. Unless, I mean, I guess B-boys do. They just push and jump and catch. So, for the most part, it's not really like the way. But yeah, like training the mistakes, I think it's really, it's at least one thing that'll give you a sense of where it's at and what's going on there, and if you have that, then that gives you more information about how to deal with stuff. I think, but I guess primarily, if you train like train the mistakes, which I think is a good idea. Like it's nothing more than like you do that for 5 minutes during training when your intention is now I'm going to train in all these weird positions. Like, I don't think that was going to negatively affect anything else you do as long as, like, your intention on what you're doing is clear.
Yeah. No, definitely, like, it is that intention thing. Now, it does also pose the other question is, like, are they good because they can do the mistakes? Or have they done the mistakes so many times they're good?
I would lean in the second direction.
Yeah.
Due to, like, I more or less know how both of them have trained. So that kind of becomes a result, but you could also do in at least in part the other direction of just like actually practicing being in various positions,
because like that's the thing, you will end up in all these bad positions at certain stages of your balancing career. Like it's just going to happen wherever you're losing, trying to fight against it. Whereas if you were going to go in like, oh, I'm going to actually practice doing things wrong.
Yeah.
And then I'll have a very clear thing of like, oh, I'll let my legs hang over the top, or I'll pike my hips too much, or I'll open my hips too much. Can be, yeah, I think it's something worth exploring.
Yeah, it's like, I know, just chatting a bit to Josh as well. I haven't talked to him in years, and he said that, like, when he was learning the one arm, that, like, I mean, he was training with you, and that, like, of course, a lot of the methodology at one point was just try to stand on one arm as best as you can. And he described it in very similar fashion to how I like to describe it. Like, yeah, he said, like, yeah, but it's like, in the end, like, maybe you just have to make all the mistakes until you know what they are like, so that you can react to them. So in one sense, obviously, like, you need to try to do things correctly when you're trying to do it correctly. But yeah, I do think there's use for at least, like, having a sense of where all these various places are. Because, like you say, you're going to end up there, even more so if you're, like, a performer or someone who tries to do really complicated shit. Like, for so many attempts, you're going to just fly off in the completely opposite direction of what you want. And yes, it's annoying and, like, it feels bad. But at least you know that you have explored that area.
Yeah, just some thoughts, some sort of go. But we actually have a topic. Topic. Yeah, we've been away for a while, so we're picking up where we left off. It's been a busy schedule for the two of us, so we'll be back on more regular schedule, I suppose, once you've finished your holiday.
Yeah.
I'm going for 2 weeks or something. Yeah.
I'm not just gone for a week.
So. Oh, cool.
Short one. Yeah.
So I might do a solo show in there just to keep things rolling. Anyway, don't hold me to that, anyone. Who knows what the baby will throw at me. So we have a topic we're picking back up as part three of our exploration of the true art and science of handstand by Professor Paolo Netti and Robert L. Jones. We got to about chapter 13, if you're following along with your own copy. We're into advanced balancing on one hand. And yeah, I think it starts with a great line, this chapter. And this particular chapter concerns rather advanced work. And probably not too many of our readers will ever try to apply the information here disclosed. But neither do most of us ever expect to own a yacht or a private swimming pool or a personal air limousine. Yet we all delight in a bit of daydreaming about such things and in building air castles with ourselves in the master's study, etc. Yeah, I think that's, you know, it does kind of nail a lot of people like information. People like the information back in the day and like to know how things are done. And then that sort of gives them a choice whether they want to do it or not, or they just want to talk about it. But also you kind of nailed it, like, you know, the classic, like, flexing on social media thing of, like, daydreaming about building castles and limousines, a sky limousine. What the fuck is that? An airplane, I assume? You know, and swimming pools and stuff like that. And I suppose it's a bit of voyeurism that we still find in social media where, like, oh, we look at people flexing their nice stuff and then we're like, ooh, I too could have an air limousine that lands in my swimming pool because my swimming pool is so big. And so it's kind of, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, it. I think it's also good what he says here, but, like, not many will actually try to apply the information that the hero disclosed. I think it's a lot like that. At any time, I mean, like, a lot of the, I often come across people that are like, oh yeah, I want to learn this, I want to learn this, I want to learn this. Like, that's my goal. And I think that's great. Of course, I'm not going to be discouraging towards that, but, like, I think very often you don't know what that means, what that goal means, because of the stupid amount of training that goes into things. Like, if I say, like, I'm gonna go and have a PhD in mathematics. Like, it's technically possible that I get one, but like, I'll basically need to start like the most basic mathematics there is, and then work my way, and then probably spend like more than a decade getting up to speed. You know, like, yes, it's possible, but like the amount you perhaps don't know the amount of dedication needed, nor do you know how much you have when you start out. So, but obviously, like, the daydreaming is very important, I think. And like what he says there, like, it's it's what I think is so fascinating in general about this book, if you like kind of look at the like the way the book is contextualized in one sense, is, I mean, and it of course makes full sense that the things that they were thinking are very similar to the way that we think, because they're humans and it's just 100 years ago. But when you see black and white pictures, when you know that they were living in a world we couldn't recognize, nor could they recognize ours.
Yeah.
It's easy to kind of, or like, it's hard to remember that, okay, yeah, these, like, it was probably pretty similar. Like, handstands weren't any different. Like, people thinking about doing the various things weren't very different. But at the same time, it's kind of like almost quote unquote surprising when you read, like, oh yeah, they thought like that too. And then you think again, you're like, no shit, Sherlock, of course. Like, nothing has really changed in a way. Yeah. But it's cool to see them describe a lot of the stuff in like a very similar way too.
Yeah, that's what I like about this book, actually, because there's something like, you know, people know I go through, like, I've read a lot of modern sports science books and other stuff, all the classics, but I've kind of shelved them. A lot of my personal research is looking into history of stuff, how people did things, different skills, where it appears, blah, blah, blah. And one of the things is all these books and manuals you find from back in the day, they were more of a memory aid to someone who was basically, particularly if you look at martial arts books or other stuff, it's like a memory aid for the person teaching, so they don't have to remember everything. But they have had this, what would have been like an oral practical and kinesthetic practice. It's like you would go, you train with your teacher, they would demonstrate the movements, you would copy them, or they would tell you what to do, you would try and replicate them, they'd tell you yes or right. All the details and the nuance would be passed on mouth to ear, not in a book. And this book, I suspect when you read it, it is like being around a conversation with these guys. Like, you can imagine just like
definitely
sitting at a coffee table or in a training hall, you're doing a few sets, and then, you know, oh, you're a bit tired. Your teacher sees you're a bit tired. It's like, oh, I'll tell an anecdote just to actually kill a bit of time so they don't notice they're resting a bit more. And that's what I kind of really like about it. I suspect this book was probably dictated, judging by the tone. It was like dictated and someone was typing it out rather than just typed.
Yeah, it does seem like that, because there's a lot of like these anecdotes in here, and then there's like it's quite a casual, like the language in it, and like and also like the way that like there are these like small sentences added in, like where he says that like and then he drops lightly the rest of the way into the half-arm planche, and from this position, he takes a moderate kick with the legs to get started, and then presses back up to the one-hand balance. This, lads, is something. and then what he means is like basically lowering the crocodile and kick back up on one arm, which is a something. But like, the tone of it is like, definitely very much in a kind of a casual sense, and it's really cool. Like we also discussed in the previous episode, I do find it also really cool to see that, like, I mean, when you look at like the various like movement arts, there are very few of them that have come up with a whole lot of new stuff over the years. But it's like, it's very often like, oh yeah, this new thing came, like someone is doing something new. Like if you look at like in street workout, there you have like a very few like new elements coming in with people like twisting their wrists around and doing weird shit, because like that's how street styles often develop. But a lot of the stuff, most of the stuff, like, I mean, through gymnastics, of course, but also through old circus and what these guys were doing, like the things were around like way, way, way back when. And like, you'd kind of imagine, I remember like on forums on gymnastic bodies, actually, I remember Coach Summer even wrote that like a one arm planche wasn't possible. And then someone posted a video of actually B-Boy Pivet, the dude from Brazil who has some leg atrophy, who did like a video where he like hand hops and he dropped into a perfect one arm planche. And I actually remember that Coach Summer, he saw a video and says like, yeah, look guys, like this is not that hard, that is an elbow lever, but his arm was straight, so he probably wasn't used to seeing that kind of stuff, so he didn't notice that literally what it was. And I remember like people having kind of discussed if that's possible or not, and then like 100 years ago, people were doing it, and that's just like one very niche skill. While it seems like most stuff has been done. I've thought about this in relation to breaking a bit, I call it like body technologies in a way. You have like these various movement forms that are like related in a way, because breaking has had a couple of ones that are kind of unique and new, especially with all kind of the air flare related stuff. That is something that didn't exist anywhere before breaking took it into the world. And also a lot of kind of the air chair stuff where the arm is behind and pushing. Yeah. That's like not something that was really in like positions been used in capoeira. It's been used various places, absolutely. But the direction it was taken was sort of new. But for the most part, like tricking has also done some new things. But for the most part, like a lot of it is just dates really, really far back. And I think that's like it's very cool and interesting to see that just gives kind of that parallax and that sense of time that this is not it's not that special in kind of the grand scheme of things when you see what people have done before.
I definitely think like we're in a kind of maximalist culture more so than there's like, because we have such a proliferation on social media and sharing and video and other stuff that we didn't have before, people begin to just like add stuff on to something that's been done before. It's like, I'll do a corkscrew. Oh, no, I'll do a double cork, triple cork, quad cork. I'll string a few of them together. But it's like people have been doing a corkscrew for a very long time. So it's just basically like the creative element or the possibilities are what they are. But then people can go like, I can just do a bit more of something. It's like seeing someone doing chin-ups with like, what was it on Instagram yesterday or something? Some guy doing a chin-up with a 720 spin catch and release. Catch and release chin-ups with spins, like I've done them on trapeze, it was a circusy kind of thing, not saying it was exclusive, but I hadn't seen someone do a 720. So it's that kind of maximalizing that we see as much as anything else, where there's a few people come up with something interesting and then people who possibly are technically better will maximalize it.
Yeah, and that's also one thing I think is fascinating when looking at this book and similar things is like also the way that like I am sure a lot of this, like at least some of it, was done before that generation of people too, certainly. But I could imagine, or I wouldn't be surprised if that generation there was sort of the first developing a lot of it, because of course the Chinese have had
Palinetti claims to have invented the one-arm planche.
Yeah, he also says he was the first man to do the planche itself as well. It says in the book.
I don't know. I found some things that would question that view from ancient Greece, but
that's the thing. It could definitely. I mean, the thing is, people have probably been standing on their arms for a very long time, and there have been a lot of people. He didn't know all the people, so definitely. There is something interesting with, I assume at least in creating a little bit more of a system around handstands. This seems to be one of the first attempts, if perhaps not the first, like that era of things.
Definitely.
And I think that there's something really interesting in just that. It made me think of a quote from Rodney Mullen speaking about skateboarding, where he says that he feels that he was very fortunate to have come in when there was a blank canvas. Because he could experiment so much, and there was less of an assumption of people telling you what to do. It hadn't hardened yet into kind of the shape that this is how you need to train the discipline. So And that's something that's like, that must be really cool in one way. I mean, I can guess like, well, first, and the reason why Rodney says this is because as soon as you have a skateboard, you do tricks with, that is stuff that has never been done before because the object didn't exist.
Yeah.
Suddenly object exists, someone starts doing something with it and it's completely new. It's not fully the same with handstands, but like one, yeah. But still at the same time, when you're starting to really explore what can be done there and like, yeah, that daydreaming on like, okay, can this be done? Can we do like this? Like, and developing yeah. apparatus and all kinds of stuff. And when it truly hasn't really been touched on before, at least like for all we know, at least with Polinetti and these guys, whether or not they were the first doing things, I would assume that like with the limited resources they might have had to other historical records of such,
yeah,
for themselves, they were maybe the first. They had like the ideas came from
yeah.
like quite a, or like at least a less influenced environment than for us. And I like that, that must be like, that's just a really interesting kind of primordial ooze of like conceptually yeah. speaking, more so than just athletic in terms of like all the stuff you can kind of imagine. While now there is like, you're kind of rearranging pieces that are very well established almost wherever you go, just due to the amount of people and the amount of like, the knowledge you have about how much stuff has been done in a way.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely, there's one other thing that I've actually just kind of realized about this book is they seem to be teaching quite indiscriminately. Like they're teaching everyone. Like there's, you know, if you read through the book, there's always a bit like a little anecdote of this guy came to visit Paolinetti or this guy visited Bob Jones and I showed him how to do this and this guy was performing. Then he came and learned this off us. This is kind of probably one of the first, probably not the first, but definitely a first for people teaching these outside a family context. Because like a lot of the circus knowledge and a lot of the other knowledge of the show era and other stuff and speciality acts, it's like families kept it to themselves because it was their source of income. They didn't want to teach outsiders so much. And it's kind of interesting where it's just like this, maybe it's the American culture at the time of just like there's an openness, maybe the family is less important because you didn't have touring, you did have touring circuses, you did have family circuses, but they weren't as, you know, 200-year-old family, traveling troubadour family that have kept the same thing in the same family and been doing it for however long and have refined the way that they teach their kids who then go on to teach the next generation. It's kind of constant iteration and refinement. And whereas these guys there's always little anecdotes in this book of just like, and you can read it when you read through yourself, listeners that is, you'll see these little anecdotes and you can put that in context of like, before this, no one was teaching this shit open. Like, this was, as the Chinese say, this was your rice bowl. You never give away the rice bowl. So.
Yeah, and there's also something in here, like, because since you can see, there's like documentation of so many different people involved in various places and also various countries. And like, I mean, also in relation to I think the quote we took that one up. I think it's from the York hand balancing course, the one with that like a barbell men doing some handstands is as natural as duck taking to water. Like the kind of the physical culture time of, or the physical culture of the times, like how it tied into kind of like gymnastics, not as we know it, but like gymnastics being more like the idea of physical training in general. It's actually interesting in the old word we use up here in Scandinavia for just training is gymnastic, which is like it, that is like basically like my grandmother would say that's what you would have in school. Physical education would be gymnastic.
It used to be in Ireland as well. Used to this view, like you'd be going to gym. Yeah, that's the other thing. Like you'd have also like everyone kind of forgets this, or maybe doesn't think about like when you're going to the gym, as in a normal gym. It's a gymnasium. It's a short for that. There's no people exactly. say gymnasium, but you're going to a gymnasium to perform your gymnastics, and like obviously we lift weights and other stuff in the gym now because that's what's coalesced around. But back in the day, you know, physical culture era, you do a bit of everything.
Yep.
So
and you're not naked anymore since I think gymnasts.
Well, there's a lot of complaints about that naked lately. I don't know. You see these things are just like, oh, you know, women are wearing too little in the gym. It's like, no one cares. One, no one cares. Just let them get on with the thing. And two, like, go back to your roots and start training in your Y fronts. Like, no one's stopping you. Just do it. Like, you know, that's fine. Just, you know, why not? It's liberating. Just make sure they're clean.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get on to the actual technical stuff of this because had some.
So, but yeah, I just have like a comment on like the pictures of the various people in here in relation to what you said with people sharing it and stuff. Like, what it does seem like is that like there were different communities within, like, at least like within the States, like different cities, different like people, like as we mentioned in the previous episode too, that like they interchange the word like kind of circus and circus performer and gymnast, and like that these were kind of like very very much the same in a sense, and that like there are these various maybe clubs or maybe communities around, and that they would meet and they would like exchange in a way. And there also seems to, like we described also, there seems to be sort of a little bit of this like showing up each other sort of, like, because people wouldn't perhaps see each other on that regular of a basis since travel took a lot longer. So there being like, you didn't know what the other guys were doing, and then you had trained, and then you met them, and then you showed them, okay, you can do the thing. They show you the thing, and then like they're kind of like, I totally get how that adds to a competitive aspect of it when in such a context, in a way.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, what thing are you doing? Well, I can do your thing, but can you do my thing?
Mm.
Like, it's almost, you can see the start of breakdancing, I suppose. There's a lot of that in breakdancing. It's like, huh, you just did the thing, but I'll do the thing with an extra thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. So one of the things, actually, just to on the technical analysis of some of these pictures in here, is the very first picture in this chapter, figure one, it shows a very clear stack alignment where he's balancing on the inside arm of the inside line of the arm. This is what we're like, this is what we use nowadays. He's got the legs bent and he's got the hand up. But if we actually just isolate everything from the scapula down, like the point of the scapula down, you can see the muscles are engaged. There's good lighting. You can see his shoulders basically in the alignment we'd be looking for in a classic straight shape. His arm is basically coming onto the inside line. The inside line is coming sort of from the thumb and index finger up the arm, is what I term. There's no bend in the arm, nice hyperextension. So it's kind of interesting. There's like, there's a certain universality to this stack that makes it very efficient.
And it's like that picture is basically like, if we cut the picture right below his waist, and you're basically, because in this picture his legs are like are arched out to the side to keep the weight in the center, but if you cut right below his legs and you show this picture to someone, they wouldn't be able to tell whether or not this was a kind of modern style straight one arm or an old school style arched one at all. So like in that one, it's very similar, like the look of it.
Yeah, shoulders up against the ear. The head is doing that thing where he's looking at the hand, and the head is moved over, laterally flexed at the neck to get the shoulder to the ear. Whereas if you kind of look at the shoulder width and his head position, it would be, if his head was hanging down straight in line with the spine, then he would not have the shoulder to the ear. So just kind of one of those things where, like, it's like that shoulder to the ear. For me and Mikael, example, Mikael has very wide shoulders compared to his head size, and I have very narrow shoulders compared to my head size. So I just put my shoulders up and they touch my ears. I don't have to move my head. I go to one arm, it's there. They just stay there. Whereas you, like, I could just basically get an arm. You'd have to move your head over and arch it to get the ear onto it. So we could kind of stick
it. I either have to move my head to my ear or the arm to the head. Arm to the head, my arm is diagonal, of course. Yeah. So it's like it's just not practical. But like, it's interesting. I have old videos from when I used to have hyperextension on my left arm.
Yeah.
So I had like quite some hyperextension on that arm, and on those videos, like 2010 videos, you do see that like my head appears a lot closer to that arm than nowadays. So it's quite interesting. It's also cool, like in the figure 2, 3, and 4, which are like basically in this chapter, which is like advanced balancing on one arm or on one hand. You see also like they comment on this head, the head and shoulder position, where the head is forward versus the head goes towards the side. And in the forward, we see like it's a very blurry little picture of a guy doing basically a straight one arm, or like his body is like it's so blurry that you can't even see his arching, but he is. But the upper body is very similar to a modern one arm, and then the other picture, which is the side, which is sort of a bent arm, flaggy looking shape. And what they're describing here is like how you would be lifting, like doing sort of like a standing one arm press kind of thing. Like what basically nowadays people are doing a lot on flexibility by lifting one leg off the floor and leaning on the arm. While here, like most, and what you can see a lot in this book is like most of these guys here, they are not flexible whatsoever. So they are basically using what they have. They also comment on this further down, that especially the professor, Mr. Paulinetti, he did not have a lot of waist flexibility, but he did have more strength. Something about that he had more strength than any of us others could muster. So that he did that instead. But yeah, they are aware of all these things, that like there were various ways of doing stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. That's on the waist flexibility. He's not a contortionist, but his back is rather more flexible than that of the average athlete, as also is his waist movement to the sides. This is of great help in pressing up on one hand, which he does in a very effective style, beginning figure 4, pose body, and carrying slowly and smoothly without any sign of a hitch or hop, and then into the usual one-hander position. You know, so it's kind of, just an interesting thing. Like, they note all the mistakes we make. It's like, oh, I'm pressing. No, you're doing a little hop there. No, it doesn't feel like, no, I can see it. Your little hop, little hitch, you know, a little bit of momentum to get you through it. We see you.
There's also, it's also cool here. Like, it says like a little bit further down, like, because they're talking about this athlete called Johnny Weber, who was apparently very, very strong. He said that he could hop on one hand several times in succession, but without much control as to direction. When, however, I told him the professor's secret of letting himself overbalance in the desired direction, almost to the point of falling, and then doing the hop, he made it work. So, like, I remember, like, when I first saw hand hops in breaking, because like that was my first time I saw someone jump on one hand. In breaking, I think they called them Donny hops at first, because there was a guy named B-Boy Crumbs was the first guy that I can at least remember doing it, and his name is Donny. So that's at least like one term I heard at one point in breaking, since he was kind of one of the first like introducing using that. And obviously, it's been done in circus for a very long time. Not very surprising that in 1920, people were already doing like jumping on one hand as good as B-Boys are nowadays, sort of.
Yeah. And that's kind of like, it is kind of interesting on this. It's like this little paragraph here is a good, clear, contextual idea of like the oral transmission that would get off your coach on these things. Because you could find like, oh, someone's hopping. I'm hopping. I can go up and down, but this is just random. It's like, you have to fall over and your weight's too much in the heel of the hand. Like these kind of subtle details are something that might make it in, like, particularly if you look at some earlier manuals, there's stick figures or there's like woodcuts of these people doing these things. It's like, you can hop on one hand. Oh, great, I can hop on one hand, but what's going on is random. And that's just kind of just interesting. This is the thing. It's just interesting, this whole book. There's one here. Just going down. But the feat which impressed me most of all, the tiger bend on one arm, which incidentally note that the upper arm is perpendicular as it should be in all tiger bends and not slanting forward at 45 degrees as we usually see, and with the chin or nose of the performer buried in the floor.
Yeah, so I mean, if you don't know what a tiger bend is, basically like from two arm elbow stand, and then like you lean forwards to the palm and then you push yourself up. It's usually done with a little bit of like a quick and rough movement as you get to the hands into sort of a deep handstand push-up position.
Yeah.
And on one arm, like basically what he's describing there is what they call elbow ups in breaking, where you do elbow jumps, like forearm hops, and then you kick hard enough to get to a straight arm. And that's also something like when I saw that at first, I was 100% sure no one had done that in history before. And lo and behold, obviously this is something that existed like even back then. It's super cool.
Yeah.
That is... And he also says that like to hold the elbow balance is really a difficult matter to maintain lateral balance, much more so, I believe, than the one handstand. And he's definitely right. One arm elbow stands are awful to balance.
Yeah, I remember you putting some time into them.
Yeah, they're like, really tricky, and I've never actually done it with legs together. It's possible, but I've never trained it enough. But these guys were doing it.
Yeah, this guy is doing it in figure 16, just down page 116 of this book. And it's just kind of interesting. Like we note on the photography as well. Like they did note at the start of the book is the photography is all done like on negatives. Like it's not like point and click we have today. Like you had to, if you were moving, you'd get ghosting on the image. There's no ghosting here. He's holding it long enough to develop the photo. So, you know, this is, it's just cool. It's just like, okay, there's proof in the pudding here. Proof of the pudding, whatever. Then, where's the other stuff? There's a lot of stuff here. I'm just trying to see, take my notes.
Yeah, there's way too many things. So you're looking at the, at the pictures. And it's like, as you might have noticed, if you listen to, when we basically quote stuff from the book, the writing style is very ranty. Like the sentences are very long, and they're like, it's also cool. Just like a look back in time, I guess it's just also a thing of style and of times that like people were writing differently in a way.
But that's what I mean. I also think that's why it was dictated, because the sentences are
definitely
very long. And like I dictate a lot of the book, a lot of the stuff I write for other stuff, then I have to clean it up into smaller sentences. Because you just get these kind of run-on sentences, and then, that kind of idea. This one here, Tiger Brain, but on one arm, it's really difficult matter to maintain lateral balance, much more so than I believe one hand. This is kind of interesting. And generally results principally in adding pressure at the hand in the support, back and forward is come down, and you have to let the feet over forward to overcorrect the balance movement. It is a ticklish situation. Yeah.
That is the one about the elbow balance.
Yeah.
There's also a cool one down here about like, they're talking about like technical discussion about highly advanced types of balancing and work on one arm. And please understand, I make no claim of knowing the full story of all of balancing or any part of it. And he says that it's kind of the writer's opinion. And what does he say? Or that like, generally, the less he knows about the subject, the more fluently he can hold forth. Seriously, though, I've been making a deep study of balancing for just 21 years, and Professor Polinetti had only 50 years of it. The benefits of those 50 years, he tried to nobly force feed me during the 13 years we were together. And yeah, so I also think it like that kind of relates to like the kind of that age thing that we mentioned as well, like with a lot of these athletes, like a lot of the pictures are taken when these guys were like up in their years, like definitely. Yeah. There's like I was reading over, there's like further down here they describe a Japanese artist as well, and they call him Ishii. His full name is somewhere in there. But basically, that he was doing the one-arm planche at 60 years old.
Yeah.
Because he was still a performer. And I find it extremely fascinating.
There's no pensions back then or state support. You didn't do the handstand. You didn't eat. Bear that in mind for your motivation.
Yeah.
There's your motivation for this week.
But also from that perspective of just like you're having... like just the conceptualization of physicality and of lifestyle and of stuff that like it's just very obvious within this book that they are not talking about that, you need to start when you're young. There's none of that, because none of them did it either. With Bob Jones, who says that he had 20 years of experience. Like, when he wrote this book, he was in his mid-40s. He started in his mid-20s doing the stuff, and he was kind of at the top of his performance career then in his mid-40s. The idea of physicality being tied to age, being, I mean, I could also imagine, like, in the 1920s, like, a hell of a lot more work was physical. So, like, the on average use of body was just much more necessary. And then, like, it's also probably during times where, like you say, you couldn't just
leave school at 15, go work in the mines for 10 years, and then you take up hand balancing. It's like holiday.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of stuff. So there's one on the hand positions, which I think is kind of interesting. There are two positions of the supporting hand, which are considered one hand balancing. First, figure two, with the hand turned slightly outwards, but slightly indexed finger pointing dead ahead, the upper arm making a little more than a right angle with the line of shoulder. The arm is forward from the chest rather than off to the side. The extent of forwardness depends on the looseness of the back. It's always sufficient to permit the arm to be held perpendicular and viewed from the side, whether on both hands, blah, blah, blah. Also, the fingers are turned almost straight out to the side and arm is held well off to the side at the shoulder, so that the relation is more like that of doing a side press with a heavy weight. So this is the kind of talking about, like, okay, if you have they're talking about, like, the stack or close to the line as we'd know it. And then they're talking a bit more about the breaking style handstand, where you might have, you know, bent arm, shoulder out to the side, bigger V shape to your center line. It's kind of interesting, though. You know, we have one correct way of doing handstands now, whereas they were like, oh, there's two ways you can do this, and here's both of them. Now figure it out yourself. Yeah, and there you go. The side position is the more natural to fall into, but the shoulder socket does not lock well in this position, and the balance is also shaky and wobbly. So this is the interesting bit. It is so because it must be held by muscular effort, usually with the arm never quite straight or perpendicular, although not necessarily so, and not by bone strength in a well-locked skeletal position throughout. So if we think about, like, some of the street workout dudes, the planche masters who do one arms, they kind of end up in this shape. They just hold it by brute force. And, you know, that's what he's describing. It's like, okay, well, we can balance with a stacked position as we're trying to do, efficient weight transfer to the bones into the floor. Or you can just be a beast, you know.
Mm.
If brute force doesn't work, you weren't using enough of it.
Mm. It's also interesting, like, they're doing arch back style, yet they are describing using skeletal position throughout. Yeah. I love to see how they describe that, whereas, like, so many people nowadays would tell you the opposite. Oh, that's not skeletal, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And I mean, yes, through the arm, it's still skeletal. Like, there's very little other different things happening there. And yes, the arch back is just, it is literally just different. And I love that so much as well, because these fuckers were in better shape, less injured, for the most part, than a lot of people that are doing straight handstands, and they were busting stuff out in their mid 50s to 60s.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show that if it was so that, like, doing arched back, like, quote unquote bad technique handstands, that the body was not adaptable and the body could only work in this one particular way, this book wouldn't exist. This technique wouldn't exist, because they would be breaking down and having destroyed bodies.
Yeah.
But no, like, they like Paulinetti's doing a fucking, like, full one arm and a full planche at 60 years old, and there are several other individuals being described doing the same things. So it just goes to show how it's mostly about body adaptability, and, like, it also, of course, it applies to the specific adaptations to impulse demand principle, which is something that we know works. If you do a lot of mathematics, you get good at mathematics, and the body's really good at not dying. So it'll basically sort out a lot of stuff. It's not made of glass, and it just satisfies me so much. And I've used that argument many times when having that discussion with people who are like, oh yeah, but it must be dangerous to balance like this and like this. And why is it then that some of the older performers we see out there are sometimes contortionists? Well, like, they're bending their bodies into ungodly shapes all the time. If I did that right now, I would it would be terrible. But the body is incredibly adaptive, and as you talked about too, that bones even adapt and change over time due to the demand we put on them. And that my friend, when I had taken the MRI of the shoulder, I was worried, and he's like, yeah, but okay, the degeneration you see in there, some of it might be because your shoulder needs to be in that position all the time, maybe. And he's like, I can't know, you can't know, the world's best experts couldn't know unless we had one MRI picture of you for 6 months for 10 years. We might tell something, but otherwise. So it's just cool to see that how many different ways you can deal with this. And I remember when the first time, it's a drastic change of topic really, but just about the book directly, when I bought this book in 2008, when I was just getting into hand balancing, mega excited, young, and just like, wow, this was the new thing I needed to find out everything about. And of course, the most epic picture ever is on the cover of Paulinetti doing a crazy one arm planche. And I was just like, whoa, that is possible. And what was I supposed to say? Completely lost it. the fact that a one arm planche was not just possible but done ages ago, something that I literally I'd kind of theorized that it was possible due to some other stuff I'd seen, but I'd never seen it among modern circus performers, nor do you even see it very much you don't see it competed in sport acro. Many of them can do it, it's just that the points that you get for it is doesn't give you enough for it to do it, though some of those flyers are obviously I've seen several of them pull it off perfectly. And the fact that they kind of they describe it, and of course they put a lot of glory on it because it was Paulinetti's kind of biggest move, the one hand balance planche. Paulinetti originated it some 50 years ago. Very few have tried it since, and none has succeeded. They invariably roll into the side position, which even so is a real accomplishment, meaning that they kind of flag it too much. Yeah. But they seem unable to get a clear conception of the proper position. In the planche, a little side bending is necessary to bring the center of the body's weight over the hand laterally, and a slight rolling towards the supporting hand is needed to bring the shoulder into locking position, just as the half arm planche, basically the crocodile.
Yeah.
And it what he describes there, when I do one arm planche, and I could do it without a counterweight for a while, some years ago, but it was never with great placement.
Yeah.
But even when I do it with a counterweight nowadays, it's like getting that full flatness is a rare achievement.
Yeah.
It's just intensely interesting. They go so much into detail on it here, and they do say that he says that none has done it, but then further down here he does say that there's here it says that Gene Jackson, some guy, wrote that in Pittsburgh in 1935 he had seen Ichuka Ishikawa, then 60 years old, duplicate the professor's one hand balance planche in correct form. Ishii also pressed back up from the two arm planche to the normal balance without bending either arms or legs. this is the only instance I've ever encountered of such accomplishment. And then it also says that in the routine, he would lower from the planche to the elbow and then press back up to the one hand balance in proper form. Ishii could also do the one arm tiger bend and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So it's there are apparently some of the other people would imagine that 60 years old, like most people are decrepit by before 50. And then you have like Ishii who is there. And then you have like the guy marrying, they write that he does full planches at 70. And then like Paulinetti doing all that shit at 65 as well. So all of you fuckers that are listening to this and being like, oh, I started too late, I'm too old, shut up.
Yeah. I had a couple of older people by courses office recently. I was kind of liaising with them. So it's always inspirational. We got a shout out from GMB, thanks to Ryan Podcast. And then a few of their people who train with them bought some courses. And there's one guy who was like, oh, I'm 60 something and I'm training with a coach one time a week. And I want to also add a bit to it. It's like, oh, cool. You know, if this person's starting in 60, what's your excuse?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, like if you got this far on the podcast, I'm assuming you're doing handstands. That said, we did get a message from someone, and I forget your name, who said they don't actually train handstands. They just like listening to the podcast.
Oh, God.
So if that's your case, drop us a message. We'd love to hear from other people who just listen to us ramble.
Definitely.
Anyway, back to the task at hand, because there was an interesting one here. The planche is a matter much more forward than side the placement of the arm at the shoulder. Decidedly not the position shoulder in 5, 6, 7, blah, blah, blah. My version of the side planche with the assistance of a 55-pound dumbbell, which permits keeping the supporting arm vertical. So, like, this is the kind of thing. There's these, like, all these planche variations, you know, like partner planche, when you do, like, the base does a planche and the flyer holds onto them in some kind of, like, balance counter-relieving at the neck. And it's, like, it's very easy to do. And there's that old fake strongman trick where you grab a kettlebell, put a belt through the handle, and then bite it with your teeth, and then you pick it up with your teeth, and you're like, oh, look, I'm holding it, and then you hold the planche. But you're not really doing a planche, you're doing counterbalance. So
yeah,
it's kind of interesting, like, they're still, you know, using the same training methodologies, like maybe it was used for one-arm planche, that anyone would probably have to use to do them, but they could sell it as a feat of strength. It's like, look, as I pick up a 55-pound dumbbell while balancing on one arm, you know, I can guarantee that was probably in a show. Just boom, check it out.
Yeah, got that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
it's also like I started looking like one thing I'd say, like, for anyone that's like really interested in kind of history of these things, like get your hands on this book and like read through it, because it has so much interesting stuff, just like in relation to all like the anecdotes and all the stuff we've been talking about now, but like to look at the pictures too, like at the bottom of the book, there is an enormous amount of all these old pictures. And like, there's tons of them online as well. Like there's lots of things. But like, there's like loads of contortionists down here. There's like a lot of high level stuff, both for handstands and for hand to hand and stuff. And like all of the small pictures are also kind of, they are like, or like they're described like who they are and where they're from. Like for example, I just like looked a little bit on kind of the list of these people, and like several of them have these different there's Lillian Leitzel here too. She's a trapezist legend.
Yeah, there's actually just a paragraph before we move on to those people that I want to read out.
What?
The professor used to discuss his feats with me and assure me that they could be duplicated if anybody would just work hard enough and intelligently enough. Personally, I think that, as in military pressing with a barbell, for instance, skeleton proportions mean a lot in the planche. But I do agree on the extent of thinking that somebody ought to duplicate his pets. A few have made excellent passes at the two-hand planche, but only Mr. W.H. Merriam of Hollywood, now 70, and still doing them, ever really duplicated. The rest uses too much hollowback business. So they see you. They seen you back in the day. We see you now. And
The arched planche.
I always felt that the professor was a bit disappointed with me for not having accomplished his planches. Don't all you fellows disappoint the old gentleman and me too by falling short of the one-hander? Paul used to encourage me frequently, and I'd pass the message along to you. Really, it isn't too impossible. Now, remember, Palinetti was quite a small dude, quite short and quite slim, so, you know.
And he was like, there are some pictures. I'm not sure if they are in this book, but there was at least one picture I did find of him, like, doing a double biceps from the back. And, like, if you didn't know that he was 50 kilos, Jesus Christ, he's jacked.
Yeah.
Like, he did have some world records in, like bicep curl into overhead press and stuff. Like, his arm, like, just his upper arm, like, from the back, like kind of like super ripped, so like you could see his brachialis and stuff, which is pretty rare to be able to see on anyone, basically. He was a pretty strong man. But yeah, like there's like down on the picture section I was talking about, like it's there are a bunch from like these various like international acrobats here too.
That's kind of one of where the more interesting ones. Like, if you go down, I don't know, where are you, page 120, you can see he's doing the hand-on-hand handstand. He's doing a pike with a big lean. He's doing a chair handstand, one-arm handstand lifting a weight, tiger bend, barbell. There's some woman doing a hollow back on elbows, very deep. Some woman doing an elbow handstand. So handstand, just her elbows, and her hands are like underneath her chin. You know, there's one woman doing, what is that called? The snake handstand or the chair, where she's like doing a handstand. She's basically in a full back bend, butt to scapula, legs out straight, like a Mexican with a very, 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 very deep back bend and the legs piked. So these are like top tier contortion tricks that were, you know, being done. I don't know how, where's the pitch 29? Streamline weight balance. Doesn't say the time, damn it. But probably sometime in the 1930s.
Yeah, and like there are like kind of the like the one finger stand with a glove is here. Japanese handstand, like the very, very wide one. What did they call that one?
Guy...
That they don't say anything. And then you have, there are like you described, like, I mean, there are kind of the one arm with a people or like a person sitting on your back, like a contortionist, like wrapped around the chest and stuff. Loads of double balances, basing, flying, etc. There is one picture here where like it says that there's a picture of Sheikh Haji Tahar, who brought the first Arabian troop to America 1891. One hand to neck, on two hands to head. It is like, so there's some, the picture is so small, you can barely see anything, but it looks like it is a literal, it's a two-arm handstand on top of the head of a guy, and there's a one arm on top of the two arm.
What page is that on?
It's picture 90. And page 124. So that's in 1891. And that's an Arabian troop. So, I mean, like, they obviously had the tradition over there. There is also Egypt's El Said Nusayr proves his strength on 107. He's holding two people. Yeah, it's very hard to describe a lot of these pictures, but
there's
like
one interesting
very
one.
Impressive stuff.
Like, I've seen a lot of these replicated in kind of acro yoga, acrobatic balance circus ones, but the one I haven't seen is like some guy, you're gonna have to visualize this, he's holding another guy who's lying across his arms, like he's in a half position bent of a bicep curl, and then there's another guy doing a handstand on top of that. So he's like carrying two dudes in basically a Zercher position. And the thing about like a lot of these balances as well is like we look at them and go, oh, that's cool. But these troops, like part of the appeal of these troops is they'd be in and out of these balances. Like they'd be into the balance incredibly quickly, possibly with some flips and other stuff. They wouldn't be like messing around going, you got it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Got it. Okay. You go. It'd just be like, boom, next one. Boom, next one. Boom, next one. it wasn't long setups in these things.
Hmm.
Some guy basing two people. Is that three people? So he's basing, yeah. He's basing in a wrestler's bridge. So that's a bridge on top of your head. He's got one person in long arm handstands, picture 105. Another person standing on his thighs, who's then basing someone on their head.
Damn, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Whoa, yeah, because he's actually on his head there.
Yeah.
In a wrestling bridge, yeah, and hand-to-hand basing, and on the thighs, someone standing with a hand, with a one arm on top of the head after that. Yeah, like, because, like, that's the thing. Like a lot of these things here, the only people nowadays would be able to replicate it. Like, circus artists wouldn't be, for the most part. Yeah. You'd have to have, like, high-level sport acro people who would specifically have to work on these elements to do it.
Yeah.
Like that, the Arabian troop there with, like, having the weight of two people on your head and, like, a handstand, like, basically,
yeah,
one arm handstand on top of your head. That is pretty busted stuff. That's like Chinese level circus nowadays.
Yeah,
like you don't see this stuff. It's also cool down here that, like, an entire page of sensational pyramid balancing work from the San Quentin prison team. Coached by Jerry Zeltz, the big powerhouse, blah, blah, blah. So, like, this is the page, what is it, 125 is literally prisoners.
Who are better now.
And they're busted good. Look at that stuff. That's, like, pretty high-level things. These could be performers. Yeah. So, yeah, and that's kind of hilarious. You get thrown in prison and you come out and you're a circus performer.
Like, that's kind of like, it would be an interesting rehabilitation thing, or just, like, you know,
yeah,
it's like, go in and teach people to perform. It's like, cool, you've served your time and you come out with something. I know prisons do have, like, these education programs, but this kind of acrobatic and other stuff would be awesome. I'm sure there's probably is someone working in prisoners teaching circus as rehabilitation. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah,
if you are, but drop us a line.
That would be interesting. That would be interesting to look into, though. Like, I mean, because some of this stuff, there must be some records of some of that. Like, imagine, like, since it's like San Quentin prison team, it means that these pictures, I mean, obviously, if that prison still exists, or people in that area should know of that, and just, like, knowing, like, okay, I would assume that the initiative behind was for the prisoners to take up physical activity, whatnot. But, like, that is a pretty cool thing. It would be interesting to see, okay, so what happened in kind of, like, did these troops then, like, did they actually become a troop when they exited the prison, or whatever kind of was the thing, and who started it, and, like, what was the kind of the idea behind it and stuff. There's, like, so much, like, depth to that shit. That would be awesome to find out.
Yeah, that would be awesome. If you know anything about us, drop us a line and we'll have a chat with you.
That would be super cool.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that was the last page of the book. We have reached the end of the journey through the fantastic Paolo Netti.
Indeed.
Yeah. You need this book. If you haven't got it, get a copy. Other than that, anything else to add?
No, I'll just say, like, yeah, it's super inspiring for anyone. So if you're interested in hand balancing stuff, if you're interested in, like, the history of these things, it's an invaluable resource, and mostly for the anecdotes, for kind of the wonderment, in a way. So it's highly recommended.
Yeah, I think it's one of those ones you could read out loud. I think reading out loud has really helped with just all these little quotes. Other than that, we've been the Handstand Cast. You guys have been great, and this is the exit music.
The Handstand Cast is brought to you by Handstand Factory and is produced by Motion Impulse. Thanks for tuning in. You can find a full transcript of each episode along with the show notes and any relevant references on handstandfactory.com/podcast. Thanks to Isaac for editing and Jordan for transcriptions. Music by Daniel Horworth. If you want to support the show, you can buy us a coffee on buymeacoffee.com or consider starting one of our Handstand Factory online programs. Links are in the show notes.